I love and always have loved my ex-wife, and that looks like it's going in a direction of completion. And the thought of having her back in my life and the kids.
Well, you'll have to use that computer to get them to listen to a tape of this program, and everybody knows Tim loves everybody.
Yeah.
That's good news, because when you love them, it's easier for them to love you.
Yeah. And I think me and my ex-wife always loved each other. We were running from each other.
Uh-huh.
We were running from ourselves. And that's what we've kind of learned through our communication with each other. So I look forward to starting a new life with her. I really do.
Well, I'm going to have to say goodbye, but I certainly want to thank you, and I want to thank these folks that came with you. They gave you a ride here. They support you. They're smiling for you and about you. You have a lot of support right here in Portland, even though your family is not here.
Yeah.
Everybody's rooting for Tim to do well, because we know you got it in you to do well, so let's see it happen.
All right, I appreciate that, and thank you for letting me talk.
Okay, I was glad to have you on the program, and I thank everyone that came with you. And I'll just say good night.
Billy Rose was a low rider. Billy Rose was a night fighter. Billy Rose knew trouble like the sound of his own name. Busted on a drunken charge, driving someone else's car. The local midnight sheriff's claim to fame.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Harder They Come as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Harder They Come is a 1972 Jamaican crime film. With dreams of becoming a successful reggae singer, a young Jamaican man, played by Jimmy Cliff, finds corruption from his record producers and the drug pushers they're connected to. Again, that's The Harder They Come, Thursday, July the 9th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Oh, as sure as the sun will shine, I'm gonna get my share right now. What's mine? And then the harder they come, the harder they fall. What a God.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the River Signal, so stay tuned.
The River Signal.
It's practically standing still.
An original radio story written and recorded on the Channel Princess as it floats down the Mississippi. The River Signal features music and voices recorded on the bow of the paddle wheel riverboat and is inspired by our conversations with the performers we meet along the way.
Following 10 seconds of silence.
5 days in the sky.
Actually, the slower you go, the hotter the motor gets. So if you're in traffic, stop and go traffic, the motor will get really hot, and the heat will come up off of the manifold and stay in the air above the motor. The best motor I've ever had for cooking was this 1965 Ford Custom. It was like a Galaxy, but not so fancy. It had a straight six in it. The manifold was like a shelf. I wire them on. Yeah. I lost some really good tamales one time. Highway 99 up in the Bend. This woman in Portland, actually, she gave me these tamales that she had made herself. I'm like, oh my God, these are beautiful. And I got some tinfoil out and I wrapped them all up. You know, I'm like, I'm gonna eat these in Bend. You know, this is gonna be so good. And I put them on the manifold and I headed up the road, you know. And I got to Bend and I was so hungry and they were gone. I can do simple things, beans and rice. I can reheat anything. If you're in a hurry, you go and get a frozen burrito and 35 miles on the manifold, and it's nice and done and crispy.
Episode 6, The Carp, featuring Charlie Parr.
How I love to wake with the early birds. The wind's low and the air tastes sweet, and as the sun crests over the trees, it casts a brilliant orange stripe across the river. It feels good being out here all alone. The boys, they're still conked out in the cabin. They're up into the wee hours, flipping cards and knocking back buckets of tub sauce. I expect they'll be snoozing a while yet. The fish are starting to stir, leaping high for their morning meals. I sit, pole in hand, trying to figure out what's on their menu. For starters, I cast out tin spinners and willow worms. No luck there, so I move on to twiddle bugs and drip snails. Still, nobody's biting. These must be some snooty fish, turning down such a gourmet smorgasbord. Well, that's peculiar. Up ahead, a bunch of blackbeaks are circling over something in the center of the channel. It looks like a floating mass of muck and scum. When the boat's close enough, I dip my finger into the ooze and give it a good whiff. The smell is awfully familiar. There's only one fish I know that can stir up this much sediment, the carp. Judging by the stench, I guess he came here no more than a few days back. Maybe he's still here. Maybe I'll get another stab at him. What do you know? The envoy left out his radio. Usually, he keeps a tight clutch on the thing, but he must have dropped it last night. It's been a while since I've tuned in to the early morning signal.
You're lucky enough to have some sheep. I was sure to snag you some suckers. But for buffalo fish, I typically have the best results trolling stink bug. And make sure to keep a tight grip on your pole. Those buffaloes hit hard and can steal the rod right out of your hands.
Bottom feeders! Boy, does this show bring back memories. All those mornings fishing with Dad, listening to old Charlie as we casted our lines. Dad got me started early, had me catching bluegill before I even learned to walk. And on my 8th birthday, I was pulling in bigger pike than most of the elders. To this day, I think I'm the only Itascan who has ever ridden a buffalo fish.
Now, if the catfish aren't biting, just wrap a night crawler in cabbage grass and dip it in mustard. I find that worm broths tempt even the pickiest of eaters.
Never heard that one before. Now I've just got to find some mustard.
Well, I guess it's time for the state of the river. Here's the short version. Not real good. I've been fishing same as always, but the river suddenly feels empty, like all the fish have gone into hiding. I've got a feeling it might be that carp those river folk were talking about. I still haven't seen the thing myself, but I bet it's only a matter of time.
I knew that blubber bag was close by.
From what I've heard, we can expect the carp to swallow pretty much all the plants in the riverbed, and most of our fish too. I wish somebody would just hook the thing and yank him out of the river. Anyway, I wrote a little song about that fish. I think I'll play it right now. You're listening to Bottom Feeders, your one source for the culinary survival on the big river, broadcasting from Crooked Slough, where the willows dangle and the grass turns blue.
When the carp dredged our riverbed and ruined our fishing holes, the village chose me to chase it down. Seems me and Charlie have a lot to talk about. Wait a second. The banks of the confluence we passed a mile back were covered in willow and blue blade. I bet that was Charlie's tributary. Hope the boys won't mind a slight change in course.
When I wake, the boat's already moving. That's weird. I didn't hear the engine start, and I'm a pretty twitchy sleeper. Then again, Huckins and I did finish off that tub sauce last night, which maybe wasn't the best idea. I feel like someone poured acid in my eyes and force-fed me a bucket of shingle dust. I sit up and look outside. The river seems awful narrow here. To either side of the boat, it's high grass and down trees, not 10 feet away. This can't be the main channel. Where are we? I join Reed up in the wheelhouse. He's listening to the signal and whistling along with the music. That guy's always whistling. Before I can even ask what we're doing out here, he turns and says, "Current was weird, so I turned into a backwater." Something about this doesn't quite sound right, but I'm too bleary for critical thinking. This sure is a backwater. The channel's barely wider than our boat, peppered with stumps and swamp grass, and the trees on either bank lean over the water, their branches tangled. There are all sorts of critters, too. Crickets and peepers are everywhere, a couple weed runners play in the shallows, and somewhere out in the muck is one of those jumbo bullfrogs, the kind that sounds less like a frog than a cow in labor. Back in Superior Land, I read some about the backwaters. Even daydreamed a bit about claiming one for myself, building a home and hunkering down. But I don't know. It's real buggy out here, and the mud smells like Grandpa's outhouse. Awful lonely, too. I wonder if anyone does live out here.
Okay, so once you've serenaded your catch, you're ready to cook it. And if you're a bottom feeders listener, you know I only cook fish in the exhaust manifold of my four-cylinder Delphi. I guess you could use an Iron Duke, or even a Big Block, but neither of those burn blubber quite as clean.
I step inside and turn up the radio. Did that guy just say he's cooking fish on an engine?
You can wrap the fillets in foil, but I like to just set them right on the metal. Gives them a bit more zing. Once you've got your fish cooking, it's time for a second serenade. Maybe something sweet, like this one.
Now Huckins comes up to the wheelhouse, rubbing his eyes. He starts to ask what we're listening to, but Reed shushes him. He appears to be taking notes. Halfway through the song, Reed steps out to the bow and leans over the rail. He's looking off at this dense cluster of overgrown hardwoods. There's some sort of building back there. It's a beached houseboat, and it's actually in good condition. Well, maybe that's a stretch. Half the windows are boarded, and the paint's peeling like birch bark, and the porch is so off-level it looks more like a loading ramp. But someone lives there. A sign tacked to the flimsy siding says, "Bottom Feeders." And on the side of the house, in a screened porch, there's a man sitting beside a big, ugly engine. He's tapping a bare foot as he plays guitar. Reed jumps on the bulkheads and waves, and the guy, still playing guitar, gives a nod and a smile. I'm getting the feeling it was no accident motoring down this particular channel, but I don't care. That fish smells good. As Reed guides the boat toward the dock, I ready the lines.
Charlie gives us a warm welcome and shows us around his property. He's got his houseboat chained to an enormous cottonwood, and he points out a jagged notch in the bark where he marked the water level during the last flood. It's 5 feet over our heads. I can't imagine the river ever rising up that high, but Charlie's been out here for decades. I suppose you see some pretty strange stuff if you stick around a backwater for long enough. Out here, it's just marshland. Nothing like those strongholds and exchanges I found out in the plains. Even on the Mississippi, we're usually never far from concrete pilings and rusted machines. Maybe we don't see people for weeks, but we find traces of them. Bits of trash, bones, and red brick altars. But Charlie seems to exist outside of all of that.
Let's take this with a sh- salt. But they say that once a carp lived on the ocean floor, and swallowed whatever came through. For miles around, the ocean was deserted. Captains despaired as their nets came up empty day after day. Some built submarines with spears and hooks, then dove down to hunt the carp. None returned.
We stay the night at Charlie's dock, and the next morning I wake up and get to work on our engine. The Iron Duke is an omnivore, like any decent motor. And for the last week, we've been running off Uncle Steve's soybean slurry, though the Duke's just as happy with grease or fat chops. I don't want to panic the guys, but we're running pretty low. And now that we're getting to the dregs of the tank, the Duke is starting to grumble. We'll need to find some fuel somewhere here in the backwaters, or we may be paddling our way onward.
But they say when the new Nationals blew up the dam at Cheshire, they unwittingly opened up the channel for the invasive. The carp swam down from the source and vacuumed up everything around it, leaving a slimy trail of churned milkweed and catfish heads.
I'm filtering soybean husks and floating wolf spiders out of our tank when Charlie steps onto the screen porch and fires up that Delphi engine. He sees me down on the dock and yells, "Eggs?" I nod, staring at the engine. And I wonder how he's running that thing. There can't be much fuel supply down here in the backwaters, unless he's murdering unsuspecting boaters and siphoning their tanks. But I'm having trouble picturing that. I walk up to the houseboat and join Charlie on the porch. He's playing a beat-up steel guitar. The soundboard's a maze of scratches and dings, and half the tuning forks have been replaced with lug nuts. Sounds great, though. As Charlie's playing, I notice a funky smell in the air, like something is fermenting. I walk around the porch trying to look casual. When I find the source, a big black tank down behind the engine. It smells so foul, I almost have to squint looking at it. "Northern suckers," Charlie says. "Only thing around here that burns halfway clean." It takes me a moment to realize that he's talking about fish. That's the smell coming from the tank. "Back when the Northern Passages opened up," Charlie says, "all these tough Arctic fish started coming down the river. At first, nobody wanted anything to do with them. The meat is practically bulletproof and it tastes terrible. But then some river folk figured out you can peel off their blubber and burn it. Smells like rancid coconut, but runs like a dream." I'm surprised when Charlie mentions river folk. I wonder why Reed never said anything about northern suckers. We could have been running this boat off blubber the whole time. Charlie loads two plates with eggs, smoked fish, and mango, probably from that tree in his yard. As he hands me a plate, he says he's not sure how much longer he'll be able to rely on northern suckers. That carp wreaked havoc in the headwaters. And from what he's heard, suckers are disappearing from the Mississippi. He's not sure what river folk are using for fuel now, but he hopes Reed might tell him. I think we're going to share a meal, but now Charlie steps to the door, eating as he goes. He's going to take Reed out in Tamale, he says, catch a few fish, maybe talk about the carp. They'll be back sometime between noon and later.
I'm sitting in Charlie's kitchen, pretending to write in my journal, but really just waiting for Reed and Charlie to motor away. They're in his little skiff, Tamale, I think he calls it, and they're headed towards some sleepy little cove. According to Reed, they're going to catch us dinner, but I don't know. When he got in the boat, he had that weird hungry look in his eye, like a cat at a bird feeder. I've got a feeling they're after the carp. At any rate, I'm glad they didn't invite me. Hawkins is out there on our boat, tinkering. When he learned about Charlie's setup, he got real excited, and now he's overhauling our engine, trying to get it running on 100% fish blubber. He'll probably be at it all day, so it looks like I've got the place all to myself. Finally. I head to the screen porch. I've been waiting all day to try out that radio. When I fire up Charlie's engine, it whines for a second, then settles into a nice purr.
Burn to our heroes. We find them in an unfamiliar land. surrounded by mystery and fruiting trees.
Huh.
And in the end,
I've never heard the signal coming through this clear.
The welcome back,
maybe I need a better radio.
Front door,
or maybe it's just stronger down here. I'm pretty sure she said something like that.
The weather is warm. The crocuses are out. The buzz of mosquitoes is unrelenting.
She. Sounds sillier every time I say it. I mean, here I am, far from home with two guys I barely trust, all because of some girl whose name I never even learned. I don't have a picture either, and I only heard her voice that one time. It was a pretty standard day in Superior Land. I woke in the barracks, put on my flannels, and reported to the foreman. I spent the morning arranging pine boughs so as to hide the razor wire, and by mid-afternoon, I was ready for the few visitors who'd emerged from their alpine log fortresses. I started the tour with a nature walk. They always got real excited about the black bear I drugged and propped up near the trail. And then I took him to Upertown. We hit all the hot spots, the Grange Hall, the sawmill, the stopes where miners dynamited walls of frozen compost, and then headed to the Rusty Nail, where we had some laughs with Moose and Angie, who'd been pumped full of weapons-grade brandy but were still alert enough to keep their legs crossed and avoid rattling the chains. She probably slipped into the crowd there, in the bar. Or maybe she was waiting outside. I'm not sure. All I know is I had the group out on the Big Lake viewing deck, and I was given my closing lines about DeSimple folks living DeSimple life, when this woman with whirlpool eyes appeared out of nowhere and asked, "Where would you go if you thought you could leave?" I managed to shrug and got back on script, but she must have read my eyes, because a few minutes later, when the other visitors were distracted by the fake northern lights, she stuck a folded blue card in my flannel pocket. By the time I had the chance to read it, she was gone. It took me a long time to get out of Superior Land, and even longer to understand all the stuff on that card. River signals and howling winds and the Delta congregation. I think I've pieced most of it together by now. I've found the signal and heard the howl, and I have a feeling Huckins is taking us toward that congregation. But I'm still confused by a couple things. Why'd she give the card to me? And what did she mean by, "Come find us on the lost caboose"? Only one way to find out.
This is Envoy Benson transmitting from Bottom Feeder's boathouse. I'm looking for a lost caboose. Lost caboose, do you copy? Lost caboose, copy?
I'm not sure I'm working this thing right. I've never actually used one before. Maybe I'm speaking into the wrong side.
This is the lost caboose. Good to hear from you, Envoy.
I say nothing, just stare down at the radio. It's her. She remembers me.
Envoy, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
So you found the signal. Nicely done. And you're a bottom feeder's already? I'm impressed. You can't be more than 2 weeks behind us. Oh no, I gotta go. But listen, just heading downriver. We'll be here.
Play with the dial and the volume, but it's no use. The signal's fading. She really is out there, though. And she's close.
This is some spot Charlie's brought me to. The water shaded by cottonwoods, and the channel drops off quick from ankle deep to 20 feet. Charlie says he catches all sorts of cool little fish out here, and I believe it. but I think we both know we're not out here for the little fish. Charlie sort of reminds me of my dad. When he was teaching me to fish, Dad always liked to explain his methods in great detail. And Charlie's no different. If you're baiting the line with turtle tail, he tells me, you want to make sure the barbs are full poke through the skin, and that the tip is free of the hook so it mimics a minnow when you reel. Charlie's showing me again when the black beaks interrupt. Just like yesterday, the birds are circling over the river, and the water below is carpeted in a brown sludge. But today, it's thicker. It's fresh. Now Charlie's got both hands on the oars, and I start straightening the barb of his largest hook. Then I lash it to a spare oar. Not the finest harpoon I've made on this trip, but it should hold. Just 100 feet off port, an enormous blimp of a fish emerges from the water. It twists grossly in midair, and for a moment, I almost feel like it's looking at me. When the carp crashes back down, the impact sends a huge wave at the tamale, flooding over the gunwales. Neither of us says a thing. Charlie just starts rowing towards the rippled water, and I stand on the bow, harpoon raised. Above us, the black beaks are swarming, darkening the sky. This time, the carp breaches right in front of me. It goes straight up, like it's full of hot gas. And for a moment, I wonder if it might just keep going, higher and higher, out into space. But now, a shadow spreads over the tamale. The carp, it's gonna land on us. On instinct, I draw back the harpoon and manage to release it before Charlie grabs my shirt and yanks me over the boat. The tamale's gone. And all that's left is a floating mess of kindling. I swim hard, sure the carp is following. But when I reach the bank and drag myself up, I see that the muck trail's heading upstream. Charlie plops down on the beach beside me. He looks at the rubble that was once his boat and whispers, "That was one fine tamale." He seems pretty sad. I'm not quite sure what to say, so I tell him a few weeks back the carp got my boat too. Though it wasn't much of a boat, just a bunch of trash I tied together. But Charlie just stares at the water. I wonder if he even heard me. Finally, he looks up smiling and says, "As far as I know, nobody's ever speared that fish before." It takes us the better part of 3 hours to get back to the houseboat. When we arrive, we find the envoy on the porch, whispering into the radio mic. Upon seeing us, he bolts up from the table and insists he was just looking for the bathroom. But Charlie cuts him off. He tells the envoy to stay where he is and asks me to fetch Huckins from the boat. When Huckins and I return, Charlie is sorting through a pile of electrical odds and ends he's dumped on the table. As he shuffles through, he says he's been pulling this stuff out of the river for years, hoarding it, waiting for someone who'd make good use of it. Now he backhands most of it to the floor, leaving just a few cables, a black box with big knobs, and an absurdly long antenna. "This," he says, "is what you guys are gonna need out there." When none of us reply, he adds, "You do want to get on the signal, right?" The envoy, who's been hiding in the corner now, says, "We can do that? From the boat?" Charlie nods and says, "You can get a good 200 watts off that Iron Duke you're running, especially if you're burning pure blubber. It'll be good to have a broadcaster who's actually on the river. All's old-timers, we may be tuned in, but we don't get out much." Then he looks at me and says, "Plus, I want to know when this guy gets the carp." As the sun sinks lower, we work on the boat. Huckins tops off the tanks with blubber, the envoy installs the transceiver, and I bolt a huge antenna onto the roof. All the while, Charlie sits on his porch, playing that old steel guitar.
Gonna be one more.
Just as it's getting too dark to keep at it, the envoy gets static through the speaker. The transmitter's working. He calls Charlie down to the boat, asks him what we ought to do now. Charlie shrugs and says, what everyone else does, say something worthwhile. I figure the envoy is going to give it a whirl, try to talk to that girl he keeps mentioning, but instead, he hands the radio mic to me. For a moment, I just hold it, but then Charlie nudges me in the ribs, so I take a deep breath, raise the thing up.
This is Reed, broadcasting to the River Signal. I'm heading downstream on a paddlewheel riverboat in the company of a walker and an escaped Uber, and I'm looking for anyone who can help me take down the carp who ate my banjo.
Gonna be one more when I'm gone. Gonna be one more when I'm gone. And it's all I've got is gone.
This episode of The River Signal was written and recorded by Galen Huckins, Brian Benson, and Reed Lustig. Audio editing by Jill Shupak. Special thanks to Charlie Parr, Jason Powers, Anna Vodica, Ear Trumpet Labs, and KBOO 90.7. For pictures and video of the riverboat trip, and a video of Charlie Parr performing at One Crane Cove in St. Paul, Minnesota, check out riversignal.com. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for Episode 7.
The Riverboat Sessions.
This week, The River Signal was inspired by our session and conversation with Charlie Parr. We recorded him on the Channel Princess in One Crane Cove in St. Paul, Minnesota.
When I first see Charlie Parr, he's perched on the hood of his Kia, bare feet on the bumper. He just drove down from Duluth, then got caught in Twin Cities traffic, and he looks pretty content staring off into the woods. I feel kind of bad interrupting him, but as soon as he sees me, he hops off the hood, smiling, and wrestles his guitar from the back seat. The car is teeming with instruments and clothes, because as soon as he's done recording with us, Charlie's setting off on a long East Coast tour. We walked a half mile down to One Crane Cove, the fishing hole where we've been anchored for 3 days. Though the cove is just downhill from the St. Paul Airport, you'd never know it. All day, it's just crickets and cottonwoods and a few fishermen casting for bass. It's the perfect spot to record Charlie. I've seen him perform a few times over the years, and no matter the venue, his music always makes you feel like you're hanging out in his porch. Today, he'll be playing on ours, on the bow deck of the Channel Princess.
My home is where my love lies. was it lost amidst the escapes that escaped from underneath the streets? Hides and doorways and faces and makes a lake seem now the waves roll and crash and retreat. My home is where my love lies. My home is where my love lies. My home is where my love lies. Ships that are bound for Norway, and they push out over Lake Superior, pass across, pass the light to the sea. My home is where my love lies. My home is where my love lies. My home is where my love abides.
Last year, I put almost 77,000 miles on my car. I played 270 dates or 267 dates or something like that. I mean, it was just like literally, there was no like significant amount of time without a show in the whole year. And now this is actually the beginning of hitting the road again. I'll be out now with odd breaks here and there until almost Christmas.
Thank you.
Usually, a few people are hanging out in the banks of the cove. Just this morning, a fisherman started screaming when he accidentally hooked an enormous snapping turtle. But today, we're all alone, and it's quiet but for the south wind. Whenever Charlie finishes his song, there'll be this brief silence, which he inevitably breaks by saying, "Well, there's that one." His music is stunning, so it takes us quite a while to get around to asking him questions. But when we do, he's got a ton to say. About songwriting and growing up on the water and cooking gourmet meals on his car's exhaust manifold.
Actually, the slower you go, the hotter the motor gets. So if you're in traffic, stop and go traffic, the motor will get really hot and the heat will come up off of the manifold and stay in the air above the motor. When you're on the freeway, you know, the way the motors are supposed to work, they're supposed to be cooled by, you know, this air rushing over the motor, which also ruins cooking. So you want, you know, the best motor I've ever had for cooking was this 1965 Ford Custom. It was like a Galaxy, but not so fancy. It had a straight six in it. The manifold was like a shelf and just super inefficient, would get hot immediately and stay that way until like a half hour after you were done driving. That was really good for cooking. Like, I'm sitting in my car, then in traffic, like stop and go traffic, you know, eating beans and rice out of a tinfoil packet. You know, this isn't so bad.
You secure them on there at all, or just set them on and they stay?
I wire them on. Yeah. I lost some really good tamales once on Highway 99 up in the Bend. This woman in Portland, actually, she gave me these tamales that she had made herself. I'm like, oh my God, these are beautiful. And I got some tinfoil out and I wrapped them all up, you know. I'm like, I'm gonna eat these in Bend, you know, this is gonna be so good. And I put them on the manifold and I headed up the road, you know. And I got to Bend and I was so hungry and they were gone. So now I've got a little wire harness that goes, that you just put the food on and then you clip this wire harness over the top of them. But I can do simple things, beans and rice. I can reheat anything. If you're in a hurry, you go and get a frozen burrito and 35 miles on the manifold and it's nice and done and crispy. So, you know.
Have you made a cookbook?
No, but there is one.
Yeah.
It's called Manifold Destiny. And I have a lot of problems with it. I think that the recipes in there are untested. Because they claim that they can make shrimp. Like, you cannot cook shrimp on the manifold. It needs to be babysat unless you like start the motor and sit there and cook your shrimp. Which maybe what they were talking about, but that's not right. You gotta drive, you know? That's wasteful.
the motor's going when you're driving, you might as well use it as a heat source, but as soon as you stop and cook over the motor, now you're not using it as a motor anymore, you're using it as a stove. It's got to cook well when I'm driving, and it can never actually overcook, because if you get stuck in traffic and you can't pull off, you've got to just kind of let it go, you know. So, the best thing I've done so far has been a curried veggies. I did a really nice curried veggies that ended up staying on the manifold for 300 miles.
That's so good.
Because I just wasn't hungry. And it was a lot of food. I'm not hungry. I had a friend with me, and he wasn't hungry. We're just driving and driving, and finally, like, into the night, like, now I'm hungry. I'm really hungry. And he's like, that's not, it's ruined now. But it wasn't ruined. It was perfect. It was like it had, like, slow cooked all day. We'd been on the freeway, so the heat had been tempered by the freeway, you know. We brought it off, and there was all kinds of vegetables and this nice curry sauce that I made, a lot of garlic, and really nice.
when I was young and I wanted to do something. I mean, I play guitar all the time since I was about 7 years old. I've been trying to learn how to play the guitar. But I thought I would be, like, I would write. And so I wrote. And I wrote this, like, short book. And it was this horrible, horrible thing. It's really bad. And I sent it to a friend of mine who's actually an author, you know, and he sent me back this. It's not even a letter, it was a postcard saying, you know, don't do this. He said, don't continue to do this. He said, you might be someone who could tell a story, but this is not the way you're going to be able to do it. Well, you know, he's an honest man. I trusted him, and I still trust him. I still believe him. But I kind of mined that book of mine for songs. I got 5 songs out of this one. And I found that once I distill stuff, it makes more sense. You can tell a lot of things without saying anything, you know, or not saying much. Even the interplay between the guitar and the verses, you know, I think leads people in a direction, even though you have a lot less control over that direction than you would if you were telling them a story, you know, where you can kind of grab their arm or say, no, it's like this. But in a song, you know, you're pointing, and they might wander off that way when you meant that way, but it doesn't matter anymore because it's not your song now, it's theirs, so. You know, it's theirs to do with what they want. And there's the story that they bring to the song adds to the story of the song, so you can't, you know, I like it better because I'm not a control freak, so I don't mind them taking it and doing what they need to do with it. It told me the story I needed to hear, so I got what I wanted out of it. Well, you know, if you're stuck for ideas, I would like to be like a shanty dweller on the shore somewhere in a little shack. It's made out of one of the houseboats that didn't quite sink all the way, that I salvaged and drug onto the shore and put back together, so it still kind of looks like the cabin of a houseboat, just like stuck in the trees. Oh, and nice. I have one lawn chair, but not two.
What do you do all day?
I sit there and play the guitar, scrounge for fish.
Throughout the session, Charlie keeps saying he'd like to stow away on our boat. Eventually, though, he packs up his guitar. He's got an evening gig and should be going. We walk into his car, wave as he drives off, eastbound, his tour officially begun. And then we return to the cove, where we'll stay for two more days before motoring downstream toward whatever comes next.
For pictures and video of the riverboat trip, and a video of Charlie Parr performing at One Crane Cove in St. Paul, Minnesota. Check out riversignal.com.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 12th annual PDX Pop Now Festival, July 24th through 26th at Audio Cinema in Portland. PDX Pop Now includes a record fair, street fair, and two outdoor stages with performers such as Amber Moon, Blue Cranes, Long Knife, Mike Crenshaw, Nurses, The Stops, and many, many more. That's PDX Pop Now, July 24th through 26th at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm a loving the old lion, a winner without fail.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the PDX Leo